I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the fire and fury book cyclone around the unspeakable White House scene, President Trump has recast himself above the fray at the level of genius, and a very stable genius at that, he tweeted. From the other side of the ring, so to speak, the New York Times launched its own bold new ad for itself on the Golden Globes awards show. The truth has a voice in the Times headline, as if to say, these are the stakes. If the fight of the age is about truth, who would we trust to find it and tell it? We are in conversation this hour with two decorated searchers for public truth, men in their 60s, wannabe private eyes maybe, but they're different sorts. James Risen is a newspaper guy through and through with a master's in journalism from Northwestern. He spent years covering the auto industry in Detroit and then business stories in Los Angeles. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for the NSA domestic spying story that his paper, The New York Times, hadn't wanted to publish. Errol Morris is a movie maker, a Hollywood Oscar winner. Roger Ebert bracketed him with the titans Hitchcock and Fellini. Errol's new movie for Netflix, called Wormwood, is a six-part serial murder mystery and an essay on truth and how we find it or don't. James Risen leads off. He's part of the reporter's migration online by now at TheIntercept.com, practicing what his co-editors Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill call adversarial journalism. But forever, as I said to him this week, James Risen is a piece of New York Times history and the limits on the Times' glory. Jim Risen, you're at the center of two giant stories of our time. First, the NSA eavesdropping scandal that you uncovered, and then the New York Times' considered decision, with the Bush administration leaning in, that your story was not fit to print. You had it almost 10 years before Edward Snowden. I wish you'd just walk us through how a guy gets a story like that, and then what in the world you confronted at the paper. All in the context of a lot of concern these days about fake news, real news, who's got the truth, does the truth have a voice at the New York Times, did it ever? But tell us your story.
In 2004, I was covering the intelligence for the New York Times. Mm. I was talking to a source, so I guess in the spring of 2004, who in the process of having a conversation, the source told me, I know what I think is the biggest secret in the government, but I'm too nervous to tell you what it is, which took me aback. And I tried to press this source on what it was, and I couldn't get that in that initial conversation. And So I just decided to keep meeting with this source on a regular basis and try to figure out what it was. And over the next several months, the source was still very reluctant to discuss what we both began to call the biggest secret. And finally, as I was leaving a meeting, I guess it was in the late summer, I turned to the source and I said, you know, you got to tell me now what it is you're talking about. And over the course of the next 10 minutes or so, the source told me about the fact that the NSA had started spying on Americans in a massive spying operation that President Bush had secretly authorized. And they were going around the law and the secret court that had been set up to deal with national security wiretaps of American citizens. So basically, they had taken the National Security Agency, which was supposed to gather intelligence on foreign governments, and they had turned it on Americans. It was the beginning of a domestic spying program that has mushroomed since 9/11.
Most people don't understand about journalism that it's one thing to get the story, then it's another matter entirely to get it into the paper, much less on page one. And we'll get to that. But was your heart pounding? Was your sense that, holy mackerel?
It was interesting. I felt, you know, kind of two feelings. One, I was shocked that this was happening. But then I was also elated as a reporter because I realized this was the story of a lifetime. This was the, you know, stories don't get any bigger than this. I began to realize this was what Cy Hirsch had found in the 1970s or what Woodward and Bernstein had found with Watergate. This was why I got into journalism.
You've described the national security reporting biz as a kind of bizarre game, a contest. Everybody's in it. Nobody has a name. Take us into it if you can.
Yeah, I started covering the CIA in 1995, first for the Los Angeles Times and then a few years later for the New York Times. Really, in hindsight, kind of a perfect time to start covering the CIA because the Cold War had just ended and Aldrich Ames had just been arrested as a Russian spy. He had been a CIA officer. And the budget of the intelligence community was being cut by Clinton. And so there was like a whole generation of senior CIA people who were leaving the CIA, and they all, a lot of them, wanted to talk. And I began to think of them like, you know, I don't know if you ever saw Tom Stoppard's play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Sure.
Where Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are minor characters in Hamlet, and Stoppard tells the play from their point of view in this play in which both of them die at the end. But you watch the play from their point of view as a very fatalistic and cynical view of Hamlet. And I always thought that these CIA guys were kind of like that.
James Royston, how does a reporter like you build out a story as big as the NSA listening to all of us for presentation to the New York Times? And at what point did you say, guys, I've got it. Here it is.
You know, at some point as a reporter, you've got to go to an agency or a government for comment and their response. And I decided, you know, I'm just going to go to the NSA and try to get the director of the NSA on the phone. And I called the press woman, the PR woman there, and I just told her, I've got to talk to the director right away.
Who was now
about something. And I didn't, Michael Hayden, he was the NSA director. And I was kind of surprised that she said, okay. And she put me on the phone with him right away. And I had to think of what I was going to say to him. And I decided to just read him the top of our story, the draft that we had. Hmm. And I'll never forget it. You know, I read the first two paragraphs, I heard over the phone, he's going, And that's when I knew I got him. He just kind of hurriedly said, you know, whatever we're doing is operationally effective and legal. And then he got off the phone. That was as close to a confirmation as we were going to get right then. So I went and told our the Washington Bureau Chief, Phil Taubman, what I'd had gotten from Hayden. And then soon after that, Hayden called Taubman, the Bureau Chief. You know, he was asking the paper not to run the story. And that began this long, over a year-long process at the New York Times of whether or not they were ever going to run the story.
Mm. You remind me, I worked in that Times Bureau in the Nixon years, and we knew somehow that it was the whole place, including the upper echelons, were spooked by Henry Kissinger. Tad Schultz had your job in those days covering intelligence. He'd had a scoop on the Bay of Pigs invasion. The president and James Reston, the bureau chief, kept it out of the paper until the invasion happened. And then there was another time when President Kennedy leaned on the publisher directly in the Oval Office to get David Halberstam out of Vietnam. He said he was driving the generals crazy. And in that case, the Times pushed back. Said, no, you run the country, Mr. President. We'll run the paper.
Right.
But who was the Times serving? Who was the Times answering to here?
Well, the editors, for a long time, they felt that the government's argument that reporting this would damage national security, they accepted that over the arguments from me and Eric Lischblau and our editor, Rebecca Corbett, that we thought it was in the public interest to report this. We had a meeting with the executive editor, Bill Keller, in October 2004 in New York, not long before the 2004 presidential election. And we argued that we should publish the story, and he decided not to. He accepted the government's arguments that—
He, Bill Keller?
Bill Keller did. And then after the election, Eric and I convinced the editors to let us try again, and we did more reporting and rewrote the story to some degree. And then in December 2004, they again told us that they weren't going to run the story for the same reasons. And so they had killed it twice. I had planned to go on a book leave at that point, and so I went. Then I decided to put the story in my book, along with another story that they had killed on a botched CIA operation in Iran. And then by the time the book had been mostly edited and was more or less finished by the late summer, early fall of 2005. I told the editors the story's going to be in my book. My book's coming out, you know, in a few months, and so you should publish the story. They thought I was being insubordinate, so.
Your freedom, Jim, to put it into a book form kept the pressure on the paper, but then at some point it ended up back in the Oval Office.
Right.
George Bush told the publisher, in effect, there'll be blood on your hands if that story goes out. I'd love to hear the whole setting. Who was talking to whom? In what tone of voice? Do these guys all know each other? What was Bill Keller actually saying? I don't know Bill Keller, except he looks like Cary Grant playing a newspaper editor. Who is he? What did he want?
They had this convoluted thing that they wanted me to do, which was they would only agree to reconsider their decision killing the story if I agreed that if they then decided to, after all that, still kill the story, I had to take it out of my book. So it was like an arms control treaty. But I just told them, okay, sure. I was basically gambling that they would run the story before my book came out. And I knew that if they didn't, that I would probably be fired for insubordination. So that led to this game of chicken between me and the editors, because first, before they would even consider running it again, they wanted to reopen talks with the government over the story. Anyway, it was a very weird situation, and I lost a lot of sleep during that time. I was very stressed out.
Did you get into the White House meeting with President Bush? Did you worry about having blood on your own hands?
No, I wasn't included in the meeting.
I wonder why not.
Well, after I told him that the story was going to be in my book, they didn't want to include me in any of their meetings with the White House. They thought I was being insubordinate. So that put me in a very awkward position.
The Times did publish Jim Risen's NSA story in late 2005, after holding it for more than a year, and after George Bush had been reelected. Risen won the Pulitzer Prize and published his book, State of War, in 2006. Coming up, a last word from Jim Risen on after effects of 9/11, and a first take from Errol Morris on rescuing truth from people who don't want you to have it. This is Open Source. James Risen was sure on that NSA wiretapping scandal that he had given the New York Times the biggest story of his life in the best tradition of the newspaper. Strange Standoff, the Stellar Wind story named for the NSA program. You thought it was the Times' way to recover lost ground, to get back to the Cy Hirsch glory days around My Lai and Vietnam. They couldn't buy it. I'm still puzzled why not. I mean, this is the paper that had published the Pentagon Papers over the Nixon administration's objections. They're not nobodies.
My feeling at the time was New York Times had gotten beaten on Watergate, but that Cy Hirsch's stories on intelligence abuses after that, which led to the Church Committee, had kind of helped redeem the paper. And I kind of looked at my situation as helping to redeem the paper after the debacle over the Times coverage of WMD in Iraq. That's why I mentioned in the meeting we had with Keller, I thought this was similar to Cy Hirsch's stories on intelligence in the 1970s.
But this is the question, what's possible in journalism, really? And today, after any number of blunders, you mentioned the Times coverage of WMD, there's the whole Judith Miller story about miscasting the threat from Iraq. Does Judy Miller figure in your saga, James Risen?
Yeah. Before the war in Iraq, I was trying to get stories into the paper that were skeptical of the Bush administration's case for war, using, you know, intelligence to justify the war. And I wrote stories primarily about how a lot of analysts were skeptical of the links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda or Saddam and 9/11. And those stories kept getting buried or cut or held, and none of the editors would explain to me what was happening. But at the same time, you know, Judy Miller and other reporters were getting front page treatment for stories saying that WMD existed in Iraq. So that to me was it was deeply frustrating as a reporter to try to figure out how to get those stories in the paper when there was an atmosphere at the time, not just at the New York Times, but everywhere in the press, that there was a demand for stories that showed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That's one of the great weaknesses of the press in America, is its herd instincts, no matter what the story.
Yeah.
Once a media narrative takes hold, it's very difficult to get the opposite point of view out. You know, that's why they call it the mainstream media. They call it the mainstream for a reason. You know, it's the dominant conventional wisdom.
That's right. Bill Keller wrote as much, although I'm not sure he understood the point. He said that as executive editor, he marked out 10 or a dozen people, all smack in the middle of conventional thinking, and sort of figured, well, I'll sail by their stars. And of course, they all went off together into a disaster. It still puzzles me why the Times didn't see that trap opening. They're supposed to be the party of memory, the party of caution, the party of history. They knew Vietnam.
Well, the New York Times is the heart and soul of American conventional wisdom. It's a slightly liberal, urban conventional wisdom, but that's what it is. You know, it's the mainstream media. It's often very difficult for people to see what is the conventional wisdom when it's happening. Because at the time that everyone agrees to something, there's nobody there to say that that's wrong. And so it's a conventional wisdom is very pernicious and powerful, because if it's really the conventional wisdom, then no one is there to question it.
I wonder, I'm thinking of lots of Times reporters at the time who knew better mm-hmm. about the Iraq War. Yeah. I'm thinking of Steve Kinzer, for example, Steve Erlanger, mm-hmm. Chris Hedges, uh-huh. all of them with experience in the Middle East, all of them saw a trap opening, and they were all steered off the story by Times editors. This still kind of appalls me.
Yeah. I think it was a very poisonous climate at that time at the paper. 9/11 had a lot to do with it, and the fact that it happened in New York, it changed the climate at the newspaper dramatically, and it's something that we're still living with the consequences of.
James Risen risked prison through 6 years of the Obama administration for refusing to testify at the trial under the Espionage Act of what may have been his CIA source. The government got the Supreme Court to rule that reporters had no special exemption or privilege for their confidential sources, until finally Eric Holder declared, "No reporter's going to jail as long as I'm Attorney General." But the shadow over Jim Risen wasn't lifted till 2014. Errol Morris is a non-commercial filmmaker who pays for his art by making television ads out of a warehouse studio in East Cambridge, home of the famous Interatron, in which he has grilled Donald Rumsfeld and also Donald Trump, among hundreds of others over the years. Errol Morris's favorite among his many feature films seems to be The Thin Blue Line from 30 years ago, which reversed the Texas murder conviction of a drifter on death row. In 2003, Morris won an Academy Award for The Fog of War, drawn from the rueful memory of the Pentagon chief through the Vietnam War, Robert S. McNamara. Before we got to his new project, Wormwood, in conversation this week, I was trying to draw Errol out on the fog of truth in Trump time. Jim Risen, later The New York Times, has been telling us how the senior editorial management of The New York Times kept his biggest scoop out of the paper for more than a year under pressure from the Bush administration, but it was the story of NSA wiretapping and eavesdropping on all of us, and it was deemed to be against the security interests of the United States. Come back to where we are today in this kind of oceanic chaos and confusion about the truth of things.
But I have to object. I mean, we've been sold a bill of goods here. The bill of goods is that there's no such thing as truth, or the truth has been somehow damaged. One really healthy thing about our attempts to learn anything about the world is skepticism, a skeptical attitude towards information, towards the meaning of evidence. Truth is just fine.
But the point is only, Jim Risen's been telling us about how the Times kept, you know, his biggest story out of the paper.
Yeah. Is this a surprise?
The
puzzle is that today the Times is aggressively coming after us online in the paper, telling us truth has a voice, and of course it's the New York Times.
Yeah.
And that's all we need. And I'm thinking, hello?
The New York Times can run whatever ads they want to run. Do I think that the New York Times has a better record with truth-telling than a lot of places? I would say, yeah. But are they oracles of truth? No. You know why? Because nothing is. Everything needs to be scrutinized. Everything needs to be examined. Truth isn't served up, you know, on a platter. And it's not served up in a daily paper either. In a way, you could say that one of the hallmarks of this age, call it whatever you want, the Trump age, is that we have become increasingly skeptical about everything. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I was having a discussion with someone about the First Amendment. In the 18th century, when the framers were constructing our Constitution, there was this idea of the marketplace of ideas, that you just throw out ideas and there would be a competition among them, and good ideas would win out in the end.
Right.
That there should be no constraint put on publishing ideas. Everything and anything goes, and it will be sorted out in good time. I believe the internet changed all of this. And it changed it because it made it possible for the first time for a kind of glut of opinion, a tsunami of opinion. And what is good and what is bad? One thing I'm fond of saying is that in the 18th century, most of human idiocy went unrecorded. Now we have the internet. How do you know what's good information and what's bad information? How do you know what is just simply serving our entrenched beliefs, but may not be true? We live in a strange time. The strange time is the preponderance of all kinds of information, mostly bad, and a doubt about our institutions. It's not even whether they're truth-telling, but it's a doubt about their intentions. I've been reading the New York Times ever since I've been a little boy.
Me too.
I never doubted when I was growing up that the Times was trying to tell the truth. Doesn't mean that they always did tell the truth, that they were always successful at telling the truth, but that there was this belief that that was an inherent principle that we could all share.
I never looked to the New York Times for truth. You don't go to the newspaper for truth. You go for news, tidbits, things that you might assemble into a worldview if you read it long enough. But Pravda, we mocked the Soviet idea of a newspaper telling the truth, all of it, every day. I mean, that worries me that the New York Times is professing to be the voice of truth. Come on.
Well, it worries me too. But in those days, I felt that reporters were trying to report. There was not a kind of agenda.
Tell them what happened. Russ Baker used to stop by my office, my desk at the New York Times, and I'd be groaning and grunting at a dummy. Chris, just tell them what happened. One view, one day, but that wasn't the truth. That was the best that I could have seen and heard in 600 words or whatever.
Yeah. But now it's seen as a real free-for-all, a food fight.
Yeah.
Where even the intentions of reporters is questioned. Are they true seekers? Are they true investigators? Or are they just propagandists of one form or another? News has become, for a lot of people, some form of propaganda.
Yeah. When did it go off the rails, do you think? When we just plain couldn't believe most of the stuff we were hearing, even the world, the big picture of it.
Well, you're talking to somebody who grew up in the 50s. What can I really remember of the Cold War? Were there drills, duck and cover to avoid the ravages of atomic war? Yes, there were. And then Vietnam, which is really an important part of my life. I went to the University of Wisconsin. I demonstrated against the war. I felt very strongly that the war was deeply wrong, deeply immoral. I also felt that it was damaging America, which is a country that I loved. I felt it was the wrong thing for America to be doing and contrary to our values. So there's this loss of faith, I suppose.
Where did the death of JFK come in for you, Errol?
I was in high school, and like everybody else, I remember the day very, very, very well. But it's a watershed event in American history which has endlessly been interpreted and reinterpreted. And what do we take away from it, ultimately, is that we can't trust our government. Ultimately, that the government is interested in hiding things from us, hiding the truth from us. The government is not open. The interests of the government is not sharing with us history or what really happened. The interests of the government is involved in effacing what happened. And I think you can say this regardless of whether you side on the lone gunman theory or multiple shooters, grassy knoll, and on and on and on. The takeaway is that someone is trying to hide stuff from us. Someone is trying to sell us a bill of goods. Say the Warren Commission was right. There was only a single shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald. They did a very bad job, I would say, of selling this idea and opened up a whole set of suspicions, doubts, questions. So that's not living in a post-truth world. It's living in a world where paranoia takes center stage. Hamlet-like paranoia. I mean, I hadn't thought of it before, but I agree with you that the assassination of JFK is the American Hamlet. Because what happened to Daddy? What happened to Daddy? Who killed Daddy and why? And are we sitting really in a nest of assassins all around us?
You tweeted not long ago, "I've often thought of democracy as fig leaf fascism, the pretense of fairness, justice, and equality. Trump removed the fig leaf." But as you speak, I'm thinking, this goes way back. Have we believed a president since LBJ? Was Nixon worse? What about Reagan? Clinton, for that matter. I did not have sex with that woman. And now Trump.
Yeah. It's hard in this world not to be really, really, really cynical.
But we're not, you know. That makes it our problem or our fault. We're not cynics.
I don't see myself as a cynic.
Neither do I.
I have this version of Santayana, which I'm very fond of, and it has a kind of cynical edge to it. Santayana is famous for saying, "Those who are unfamiliar with history are condemned to repeat it." And I changed it around a little bit. I said, "Those who are unfamiliar with history are condemned to repeat it without a sense of ironic futility." I don't know about this world. I actually love this country.
Me too.
I'd like to clarify this fig leaf idea. The fig leaf idea is no one really in their heart of hearts believes that everybody is created equal. We just don't. We're honest with ourselves. You might even say that it's disingenuous to profess otherwise. But there's one thing I do believe. People should be treated as though they're equal. And that, to me, is the foundation of America. We tilt in the direction of fairness and equality. We act as though people are all equal, and the belief that they should be treated as equals. Because otherwise, this becomes a terribly nasty and tawdry enterprise.
Every once in a while, I'm reminded that there is a war about the truth in our present situation when somebody in the street will tell me, "What about the newness investigation of the FBI. That's the big story, not Trump. That there was a kind of get Trump unit in the FBI, rogue or otherwise, during the campaign, still operative now. And I'm thinking some people are onto that line of, it's a sort of a Breitbart right-wing online messaging service. I don't happen to buy it, but it's among its adherents, it's as strong as the sort of official New York Times, Trump is an idiot, fire and fury, no span of attention, et cetera, et cetera. Two, I'm thinking, are the two systems of belief, even around who the president is in our country today?
Clearly there are.
How can that be?
Well, again, I blame the internet.
Really?
I do, actually. I think when you can live in a world, a bubble world of your own devising, read the kind of news that you want to read that reinforces the beliefs that you already have, then what? The world seems insane to me at the moment. I had hoped in some small way that Wormwood would make people think about post-war America, the predicament that we find ourselves in, mm-hmm. about the pursuit of truth and about the efforts to cover up the truth. Yeah, I don't know where we go from here.
Coming up, where we go, Errol Morris is going to tell you, is forward to his new movie, Wormwood, then back to 1953 in Manhattan, and a CIA scientist plunge from his hotel window to the pavement, 13 stories down. This is Open Source. In Errol Morris's new thriller, Wormwood, and in real life, a man in his 60s named Eric Olson has been assembling clues virtually all his life, from his father's dug-up grave to the Oval Office of President Gerald Ford in the White House, all of it to verify Eric Olson's suspicions about how and why his father died.
My father was executed by the CIA. This was a fully authorized institutional decision. The only way this becomes bearable at all is if it's known, because the story for the last 40 years has been a public story. And if the story is now totally different than what the public has heard, it's very important that this story be told correctly. So if this doesn't drive a person crazy, you must be immune.
You were crazy already.
Well, whatever. But I mean, this didn't help matters.
Frank Olson, Eric's father, was a specialist in biological weaponry, an employee of the CIA on assignment to the Army at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which was working on nominally defensive strategies against germ warfare in Korea. The Olson family has won a formal apology from the President of the United States for their father's death and got a stack of documents about his career out of the CIA, but never an explicit confirmation that the government killed him. I asked the Wormwood filmmaker Errol Morris whether after 65 years he and Eric Olson were searching for an unfindable truth.
That hotel room at the Statler Hotel, overlooking the old Pennsylvania station on 7th Avenue, room 1018A, 13 stories above 7th Avenue, there's a fact of the matter. There's a truth of what happened in that room. It's not up for grabs. Frank Olson was either pushed out a window, thrown out a window, or committed suicide. Mm. And we may never know for sure what actually happened. But Wormwood is an attempt to try to investigate the circumstances of what happened in that room. It's a number of things. That's one of them. It's also a study of a son's attempt to investigate what he has become certain is the murder of his father. Here is Eric Olson trying to figure out what happened to his father, Frank Olson. But it's not a level playing field in the sense that you just go out there and you look at this, you look at that, you look at something else. You think really, really hard about the evidence. You try to put it together in one form or another. You come to a conclusion eventually. But at the same time, you're trying to figure it out. What if there are people who are trying to prevent you from figuring it out?
Right.
What if there are people misdirecting you, pointing you in the wrong direction, creating fake information that leads you astray? What then? A kind of strange nightmare. Mm. I've had the occasion to think about Hamlet quite often in the making of Wormwood. Hamlet becomes part of Wormwood. Eric Olson makes repeated reference to it. I use it throughout the series. But one of the things about Wormwood, in fact, the title of the entire series comes from Hamlet. There's the play within the play that Hamlet stages for the benefit of his uncle Claudius, and mutters that term over and over again, Wormwood, Wormwood, which in many ways is a description of bitterness, not just simply a bitter taste, but a metaphysical bitterness where the world seems corrupt, seems rotten, seems bitter in essence. And the horror of Hamlet for me became that Hamlet here returns to this court. His father is now dead. He's been betrayed by his mother, his uncle. The feeling that you're in this world and surrounded by evil. The people that you counted among your friends are now your enemies. Nothing is safe. Nothing is secure. Nothing is dependable. And in many ways, that's exactly the position that Eric found himself in.
The star of your movie, the guy who speaks for all of us, is the son, Eric.
Yes.
A haunted man. And it's his story, but it's for all of us in some way, this lostness, this feeling that we've just gone astray, we'll never find out. And it is about our identity, ourselves, our families, our remotely remembered dad. But everything is shaken by this mystery.
I think that certainly is at the heart of what I've done. The line in Hamlet from the ghost of Hamlet's father is, remember me.
Mm.
Remember me. Remember that this happened to me. Remember there is something evil here that cannot and should not be forgotten. I am deeply moved by Eric. I've heard a lot of people say that Eric ruined his life. You know, we all ruin our lives in one form or another. We all pursue this, that, and the other thing, and then it's all over with. And what do we have to show for what we've done? I think there's something extraordinarily noble about what Eric has done. He's tried to pursue to the best of his abilities, which are not inconsiderable, what happened to his father and why. It's a story about a boy and a 60-year-plus investigation that may never end for him. It's a story of family that was utterly crushed by this. To call it a tragedy is not incorrect. And it's a story about America, about how this reflects on us.
It's also a story about germ warfare against the Koreans. Do we believe that?
I can't prove that we use germ warfare against the Koreans, against North Korea. But here's my intuition, and it could be a very bad intuition. When you devote a lot of time and money to making a weapon, the chances of it being used are great. The U.S. was not going to spend a lot of time and money on the Manhattan Project and not use the bomb. And of course, we all know it did use the bomb, not once, but twice. Germ warfare, we know, of course, that the Japanese used it extensively. And we know that instead of prosecuting many of the scientists and doctors who were involved in making biological weapons for the Japanese, instead of prosecuting those people, we hired them to produce weapons for ourselves.
We didn't pursue the Tokyo War trials the way we did the Nuremberg trials.
And in those trials, were we after the people who had created biological weapons? No, not really. Fort Detrick, where Eric Olson's father worked, was set up to produce biological weapons. That's what it was there for. A lot of people working very, very, very hard to create weapons before the enemy created them. Were they used in Korea? I knew very little about Korea going into this project. And in a way, it's at the heart of it. I don't know if you're familiar that I.F. Stone wrote a book about the Korean War.
The Hidden History, I have it, signed by the man.
Good Lord. You have everything.
Almost. Everything of I.F. Stone's, for sure.
Yeah. Reading that book, I.F. Stone's conclusion was that the war was started by us. It was a war of aggression of us against North Korea. A violent war which we have forgotten, completely forgotten. We may remember a couple of things about it because of one TV series or another. Do we know that there was more napalm used against North Korea than was used in World War II or in Vietnam?
I didn't know that.
We've forgotten, or we never knew it in the first place.
What we do know now is that the war was never ended. There was never...
And hope to God it doesn't end in some kind of atomic conflagration today.
Mm-mm. You got a beautiful hero in that, Eric. He expresses in a very forthright, solid, manly way his own kind of moral, existential helplessness. And it's nice to see a good man going through it. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I take some hope in it.
The bitter irony in truth-seeking around Frank Olson is that the obsessive, skillful, relentless truth-seekers in the case are at sword points now. Son Eric sounds hell-bent on confirmation of the last details. Seymour Hersh, the investigative legend at the New York Times, brought the first suspicions on the CIA 40 years ago in the Olson case. But Cy Hersh now stands silent on the principle that it's more important for him to protect his CIA source than to close the case.
I do operate at different levels than other people because I can get information. People trust me. They trust my judgment. I'm old. I told you, I'm 79. I've been doing this goddamn thing for, 350 years, something like that. I can't blow it. Don't make this a big deal about journalism and about amazing, sensitive, and incredible thing and duh. The source is more important than the story, always.
Errol Morris, caught in the middle, can rationalize Cy Hersh's version.
Cy practices a certain kind of journalism. I sometimes think of myself as a journalist. I'm not really a journalist. I don't know what I am. I'm some oddball character working in the margins. But Cy is a kind of journalist who depends on sources, often anonymous sources. He told me, and it's really mentioned at the end of Wormwood, that Snowden was handled incorrectly.
Meaning?
When you have a source, you don't out the source. You don't make the source a public figure. You don't cause the source to flee the United States and go to Hong Kong and Moscow. You keep the source in place. You keep the source in a position where he can divulge more information and more information about what is going on covertly in the government. Cy has depended in his entire career on information that was given to him, where there is a promise not to disclose the identity of the source, not to reveal where that information came from. If you like, it's a little bit like Mark Felt, Deep Throat, and Watergate. Because what? The source, in all likelihood, by leaking information, has committed a crime and is going to be prosecuted. Unless he flees the country, or at least he preserves his anonymity. Cy has a source, and he chooses not to reveal the identity of that source. And that became a conflict between him and Eric. For Eric, what's important is any information, any and all information, related to the death of his father. For Cy, it's the integrity of his relationship between information and the source that has provided it. He has a remarkable line in Wormwood. It's a line that makes you think. He says that the source is always more important than the story. Always. Hmm. Always more important than the story. The end of Wormwood, in many ways, is an essay on journalism and on journalist ethics. I don't believe that any investigative reporter, myself included, should just be taken at face value. We should question what we hear and what we learn. Tsai is interesting to me, really interesting to me, because he's willing to stick his neck out.
Mm-hmm.
He's willing to go against the grain. He's willing to take contrary positions, not just out of the desire to be contrary, but because he believes them. He believes he has evidence to support them.
I'm fascinated by the notion that the source is more important than the story or than the evidence.
Aren't we all? He's talking about that in order to do the kind of journalism that he does, you have relationships with people.
Right.
You've made agreements with people, and those agreements have to be honored and respected. These people who have leaked information have put themselves at risk.
Hmm.
It's not as though there is no risk in revealing government secrets. Where does Edward Snowden live today?
Hmm.
I don't believe he lives somewhere in the United States. He lives in some godforsaken hotel room in Moscow. What would have happened to Mark Felt? I don't know. If Nixon had known?
Yeah.
Maybe I used to think before I made Wormwood that an investigation was like a chess game, that it didn't involve people. It involved pushing pieces around on a board. Strategic moves of one kind or another, calculations. What this story impressed on me, probably first and foremost, is that an investigation involves people first and foremost. Agreements that you've made with them, transactions based on your relationship with them. It becomes a different kind of game, maybe not a game at all.
Hmm.
You know, I am really grateful for the opportunity to have made Wormwood because it's allowed me to think about a lot of things, what it is that I do, what I hope to do in the future.
What's the spur coming out of Wormwood to have another crack at this stuff?
We live at a time where there are hundreds and hundreds of movies constantly about history, about historical events, major and minor, whether it's Tonya Harding or Chappaquiddick or Churchill. Igniting Parliament, on and on and on and on. But the histories that we tell each other often erase the whole question of how we know about history, how we learn about history. And one of the things I'm most proud of with Wormwood, it's a story about history, and it's at the same time a story about how we learn about history, how history is discovered, uncovered, examined. And I would like to use this technique in other historical stories. It seems to me three-dimensional. They were looking around corners. They were examining what we know and how we know it, what it's based on, how reliable it is. I hate to use the word, and Rumsfeld objected when I used it, although he seems to be the ultimate amateur epistemologist, the person interested in examining how we know what we know. After all, he had his catchphrases of the known known, the known unknown, and the unknown known, and on and on and on and on. Wormwood is very much a story about how we know what we know, and how we come to know what we know, and whether we know what we know. It has that ironic dimension, which I like to think is part of what I do. I don't just tell stories, I like to tell stories about how we tell stories.
Thank you, Errol Morris and James Risen. There's more on our website, including Donald Trump in Errol Morris's Interatron. You can become an open source supporter on Patreon and get weekly exclusives from us. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Truth Tellers All, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio and Susan Coyne. George Hicks engineers our show. Barry McGrath is our deepest secret. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.